he shouldn't be judged in the community. Let's see how everything falls out.
A former Bethel police officer is accused of being intoxicated on duty. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state opened bids today for developing Cook Inlet oil and gas.
Leases are getting more expensive, but the industry's also saying they're willing to invest to be able to further develop this potentially rich basin.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The state is charging a former Bethel police officer with being drunk on the scene of a police shooting last fall. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Last October, a Bethel police officer shot and killed a man in a neighborhood near Brown Slough. The man, 24-year-old Sam Alexi Jr., was intoxicated and pointed a rifle at the officer, who then shot him. Now the situation has grown more complicated, as one of the officers on the scene was allegedly drunk. Charges have been filed against Samuel Sims, also known as Colin. He's no longer a police officer, but was the night of October 2nd. And he wasn't the shooting officer, but was assisting at the scene. The state is charging him with three misdemeanors, two counts of DUI, and one count of misconduct involving a weapon. Sims now works for the city as a dispatcher, and city manager Lee Foley says they're going to keep him on the job.
Until a conclusion is reached, whether it's for the employee or against the employee, the city supports that employee through that process.
According to the district attorney's charging documents, this is what happened that night. Sims was off duty when he responded to a call to assist. He arrived to the scene in his police car, wearing a firearm. Initially, his behavior seemed normal to other officers, and he was tasked with securing the scene. However, he fell down a couple of times before becoming unconscious. The first time he fell on his knees and said he was fine. The second time he hit his head and again said he was fine, but was later found in his car, slumped over the driver's seat. He was taken to the Bethel Hospital by ambulance. Police said it was slippery that night. In a press release following the incident, police did not identify the officers present, but said one of them had fallen on slippery stairs at the home and was treated at the hospital for a severe concussion. At the hospital, Sims was also given a blood test, which showed alcohol present. The state crime lab analysis showed his alcohol level was three times the legal limit. Sims does not believe the test was accurate, and neither does his attorney, Myron Angstman of Bethel. The state has requested DNA sampling from Sims to prove the accuracy, but the defense is trying to suppress that request. In court documents, the defense argues that it's the state's responsibility to prove Sims' guilt, and to get a sample done now, months later, would go against his right to privacy. That's where the case stands now, as the judge, Dan Ogg, has yet to decide on the DNA issue. Sims worked as a police officer for nearly 3 years before voluntarily resigning 6 days after the shooting. A few months later, he was hired back as a dispatcher. Meanwhile, Bethel City Manager Lee Foley implores the community to not jump to conclusions. He says Sims did not contribute to what happened that night.
And he shouldn't be judged in the community. If we're going to judge somebody, let it be done in an official capacity, and then let's see how everything falls out.
The next court procedure in the case is a calendar call May 14th at the Bethel Courthouse. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The state of Alaska leased nearly 150,000 acres to oil and gas developers in a sale today. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the sale represents a continued interest in development in Cook Inlet that could focus on oil drilling in the coming years.
Hillcorp was the big bidder on Wednesday, picking up 19 tracts, totaling more than 100,000 acres at a price of $2.6 million. The past 3 years have seen a surge of interest in Cook Inlet. 2011 and 2012 were both record years for oil and gas lease sales, and that interest continues, says Bob Pawlowski, the legislative and policy advisor for the Division of Oil and Gas.
The leases are getting more expensive, but the industry is also saying they're willing to invest in leases to be able to further develop this very potentially rich basin.
All in all, the state received nearly $4.5 million in high bids for Cook Inlet. Of the 28 tracks that companies put bids in for, 17 of them are on the southern Kenai Peninsula in the West Eagle Unit just east of Anchor Point. Pavlovsky says incentives developed by lawmakers have made Cook Inlet more attractive.
The legislature in the past passed some Cook Inlet incentives that have allowed drill rigs to come in and do surveying, seismic, 3D seismic. The utilities have seen a need for getting more natural gas to keep a stable energy source for the rail belt, and oil is still a very productive commodity.
There's been a scramble the past few years to get enough natural gas to market to serve South Central Alaska, but companies that have shown up recently, like Hillcorp, are gearing up for the potential for more oil production.
It's our first oil well for that unit.
That's Hillcorp spokesperson Lori Nelson. The wells they want to drill near Nanilchik are the first new wells on the Kenai Peninsula in decades.
We're bringing in two new drilling rigs. Those rigs are currently down in Vancouver, Washington, getting some work done, modifications and upgrades. The first one's going to go to work in the Nanilchik unit, and the other is going to be assigned over in Swanson River.
That renewed interest in producing oil on the peninsula is raising the eyebrows of environmental watchdogs. Cook Inlet keepers Bob Shavelson says that while onshore development is preferred, like what Hillcorp plans to do this year, getting oil out of the ground in a populated area presents unique challenges.
The thing I think that's surprising a lot of Alaskans, particularly people in the Kenai Peninsula, is that the state of Alaska every single year offers roughly 4.2 million acres of our lands and waters for oil and gas leasing. So we're seeing oil and gas development coming into more populated areas, and you're seeing some conflicts between the different uses that we want to have in these areas. You don't see those things, for example, on the North Slope.
And Shavelson's other big concern with onshore development is the quick turnaround time for granting permits. It takes about a week for the state to review a company's fish habitat permits, and less than 2 weeks to complete the coordinated review process.
The safety net is being pulled away here, and we saw it when the administration worked very hard to kill the Alaska Coastal Management Program, which really was the only law we had that gave Alaskans a meaningful voice in coastal decision-making. So they rubber-stamped these permits without any real scrutiny.
Not every tract that was leased will be developed for oil and gas production, though. The state sold its first geothermal lease on Augustine Island. The last time the state leased land for that potential energy source was in 2008 at Mount Spur. With help from APRN's Annie Feit, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Across the North Slope, there are more than 100 oil wells drilled by the federal government that are no longer operational. At some sites, there are abandoned drums sunk in oil seeps. Other wells have gas leaking from them. Today, the Bureau of Land Management identified 50 of these so-called legacy wells for cleanup. Bud Cribley directs the BLM's Alaska office. He says the plan is to start with wells near Barrow that pose the greatest risk to human and environmental health.
It's going to take time, but we are committed to accomplishing that cleanup.
Cribley says the timeline and the budget for the well cleanup are still being figured out, and sequestration could have an effect on the pace. Still, it's possible that work on the highest priority wells could start as early as next year. Environmental groups like the Wilderness Society described the draft plan as a positive step forward, but a number of Alaska lawmakers say it doesn't go far enough. Representative Cherise Millett, a Republican from Anchorage, says she's happy the federal government wants to clean up some of the wells, but more should be targeted. She also has concerns about a recent proposal to use some of Alaska's oil revenue to help pay for remediation.
The BLM has not really come out with anything other than what they've been doing, patting the state on the head and then pulling our revenues away from us.
The cleanup plan is expected to be finalized in the coming weeks after key stakeholders get a chance to comment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, rededicating Wrangell's Shakes Island Clan House.
Suddenly you remember that your life goes back 1,000 years. You're reaching back to that, and it goes directly into the heart.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The high cost of travel for extracurricular activities in Sitka's schools has been an ongoing debate for years. Now the school board is going to take a hard look at whether travel costs students and parents more than just money. At its regular meeting earlier this week, the board officially opened the question of whether Sitka's students and the teachers who coach them spend too much time away from class. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
For some kids, it's a trip here and a trip there. For junior Ryan Apathy, who participates in cross country in the fall and then in drama debate and forensics through February, it can be consecutive weekends of competition. If those events are out of town, Apathy and his teammates will likely miss Thursday and Friday of school for travel. And, oh, Apathy is also in music, which accounts for 3 out of a total of
10 trips this year and missed 22 days.
Apathy, nevertheless, is succeeding in school and excelling in the activities he's involved in. Sitka's school board is concerned that Apathy and kids like him are the exception rather than the rule.
He had a math audit that said by the time a high school student is a junior, they're already a year behind in math in terms of the amount of time they have been in class if they're a student that's been involved in activities.
That's Board President Lon Garrison, who's interested in exploring a policy implemented recently in the Unalaska School District. The policy limits students to 20 absences from school per year for activities.
It's not a policy coming from a district that's just kind of doing ho-hum. It's a policy coming from a very remote district that deals with, logistical issues like we do. But is also very high performing.
The Sitka School District doesn't have a policy in place that specifically limits absences like this. It covers only excused and unexcused absences. Setting a hard cap is new. Speaking from the audience, Sitka High Activities Director Mike Vieira wondered if it would have any impact. I would be shocked, he said, if we had more than a handful of students who missed 20 days. Student Board Member Jessie Bartels, in her final meeting, wondered if the policy was missing the point.
We already have a policy where if you have a certain grade in a class, then you can't go on a trip, and I think it's the student's job to maintain that.
Bartels is also in a lot of activities in which she excels, and she keeps up her grades. She and Ryan Apathy get that they're not necessarily the kids the board is worried about, but they both have insight into the problem.
Is it true that for some kids, being in class is a make-or-break thing for their grades?
Absolutely. If you're not there to hear, what the content of the class is, you're not going to do well on the test or the content that the class is you're required to pass in order to, get the credit for the class.
I know at the beginning of the year, a lot of teachers were gone due to coaching activities, and it was tough not having them there and needing them, and the sub couldn't really answer any questions. And I don't want to be unfair in saying that I think there should be more restricted days for teachers and students, but I think it is a detriment to the student body as a whole if the teachers are gone as much as the students are.
School Superintendent Steve Bradshaw agreed to collect data on how many students are gone, for how long, and for what reasons before the board reopened the question of a hard cap on absences at a June work session. Bradshaw has always expressed a belief in whole student education. He has reservations about boxing students and educators into limits that may somehow backfire.
I'm real concerned when we go down that path of setting hard set policy, because normally it ends up trapping the school board and the superintendent and the principals more so than the students sometimes.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Last night, the Anchorage Assembly heard from the public on an ordinance that would change the way public testimony is conducted. Despite the issue being placed at the end of the agenda, with testimony beginning after 9 p.m., many still lined up to speak. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Ernie Hall made the proposal after a controversial ordinance that sought to limit unions resulted in what he perceived as several endless nights of public testimony. Eventually, the assembly voted to close testimony before everyone had a chance to speak. Sabrina Martino said she liked the way testimony was conducted during the consideration of AO 37 and that she felt the new ordinance would discourage public participation in city politics.
I kind of think that this is almost like a rebuttal for the attendance shown for Anchorage Ordinance 37, as if you are trying to maybe discourage people from actually coming and speaking their two cents. And I don't think that's good at all. That is almost like you guys are making up the rules and you don't want to hear what anybody has to say about it, and I don't agree with that.
The ordinance would require people to sign up in person on the first night of the hearing in order to testify. Tom Stenson from the ACLU of Alaska said what's important is that the assembly come up with firm, objective standards to make sure that testimony is conducted fairly and legally.
I'm not claiming to read anybody's minds, but I think one of the problems that has arisen is that the public fears that when testimony is cut off on an ad hoc basis, that it may be influenced by the chair's view of whether the speech which is being made is good or not. And that kind of what's called viewpoint discrimination is clearly not permitted. And so what we need are firm standards.
Hall worked with the ACLU to craft the ordinance. He expressed surprise at Stenson's criticisms. Public testimony is expected to be continued at the next regular assembly meeting on May 21st. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Former Alaska Governor and U.S. Senator Frank Murkowski is laying blame on environmentalists for a range of U.S. problems. In an address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday, Murkowski said green-leaning liberals driving federal policy are out of line with economic reality.
They have the belief that they can create an ideal society and still support the government that tries to create it. Wealthy liberal environmentalists simply ignore the reality. The soaring price of gasoline if you're working in Los Angeles and you have to drive 100 miles back and forth every day.
Murkowski attributed everything from U.S. national debt to terrorism on environmentalists. He said they're blocking resource development on federal lands that could break U.S. dependence on Mideast oil that he said indirectly funds terrorists.
Why don't we prioritize the responsible development here at home? We're sending our men and women over there in the military to protect the oil flow to the Western world. Well, I've given you a few good reasons to move ahead in Alaska, in the Arctic, in ANWR, NPRA, OCS, and so forth.
Murkowski said the three Alaska areas could fill the Trans-Alaska pipeline, but a government influenced by a powerful environmental lobby is preventing their development. He says the same thing is happening with logging in the Tongass National Forest, construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, and development of the Pebble Mine. Murkowski said he's devoting a portion of the summer to travel and speak on the issue.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A Southeast Village Native corporation wants to export its cultural tourism expertise. It's opened a consulting business to build on more than a dozen years in the business. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Huna Totem Corporation has more than 1,300 shareholders with ties to the Tlingit Village, about 40 miles west of Juneau. It places cultural interpreters on board cruise ships sailing the ancestral homeland of Glacier Bay. It also presents educational programs at the National Parks Lodge, the jumping-off point for many visitors. Now, those efforts have a different name and goals.
Alaska Native Voices is going to be an expansion of what we are currently working on.
Mark McKernan heads up what Huna Totem used to call its interpretive services department.
We're going to now provide consulting services for other cultural interests, Native groups, small communities and what have you, will provide these services to them to help them answer the big questions of how do they start, where do they start, and what goals should they be aiming for.
A number of other Alaska Native corporations and tribal entities use cultural tourism to make money and employ shareholders or members. But McKernan says others are looking for help.
What we have learned and what we can pass on is just as relevant in Southeast Alaska as it would be in Costa Rica, for example, or somewhere in the East Coast or the Midwest.
Alaska Native Voices began operations earlier this month. McKernan says it has no formalized consulting agreements yet, but several groups have expressed interest and are discussing options. Rosita Worrell, president of the Juneau-based Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says Huna Totem is well-equipped for the business.
I think they have the experience, they've got the professional background and business experience in it, and I think, you know, they've done a great job in terms of, you know, trying to educate people about their culture and their history, and meanwhile making a profit.
Huna Totem's heritage guides are scheduled to be on about 200 cruise ships this year. That includes the Holland America line, which sails large ships, and Alaskan Dream and Lindblad Expeditions, which operate much smaller vessels. McKernan says cultural tourism programs need to tap traditional knowledge and not just be another stop on the road.
We do consult regularly with elders and others in the community and develop resources for these cultural guides to be able to grow and expand their knowledge base.
Huna Totem operates its own shoreside attraction, Icy Strait Point, which expects about 135,000 cruise passengers this year. Traditional culture is part of most of its excursions and programs. McKernan says Icy Strait managers could also consult with other businesses interested in similar developments. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Wrangell's Shakes Island Clan House was rededicated over the weekend. Hundreds of visitors from across Alaska, Canada, and the Lower 48 poured into the small island town to witness the historic event. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver was there and has the story.
Dozens of volunteers spent countless hours preparing thousands of pounds of food for the weekend. Wrangell is a small town with a limited number of hotels and bed and breakfasts. Families and businesses alike opened their homes and meeting rooms to house the hundreds of out-of-towners. The Ferry Taku docked downtown to serve as a hotel ship. The rededication coincided with the Alaska Marine Highway's 50th anniversary event. The Ferry Malaspina did a commemorative sailing around Southeast. It arrived in town on Friday and opened its doors for tours of the ship. Travelers on the Malaspina headed downtown to watch the afternoon parade. The sound of drums and singing echoed through town as hundreds of dancers and paddlers made their way down the main street. The celebration continued as dance groups performed throughout the evening. A representative from the Burke Museum in Washington brought the original Chief Shakes pipe back to Wrangell. Friday evening, clan leaders and elders gathered in the tribal house for a private pipe ceremony. They returned to the house Saturday morning for the rededication. Shakes Island is a small, rocky bit of land. Onlookers packed shoulder to shoulder to catch a small glimpse as clan leaders in brightly colored regalia and ornate traditional hats stepped one by one under the tall bear screen through the wooden doors of the house. Two guards in red and black closed the heavy doors and the ceremony began. Out of respect for the private nature and sacrality of the ceremony, I can't include live recordings, but the small room was filled with life. The earthy aroma of cedar mixed with the smell of rain. The room was a rich tapestry of thick clothing in every color. Representatives from Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian clans from around Southeast, and even the tall towns from Canada, sat side by side, dozens deep and three rows tall. Speakers took the floor one by one and told stories of their people in the Tlingit language. Younger people took the arms of elders and helped them to stand and speak. The eagle and raven moieties are associated with the house. In four repeated segments, two eagles and two ravens put their handprints on each of the corner posts. Dancers who lined the walls performed a dance to bring the house together. Linda Churchill is one of the dancers.
It's to pull the joints of the building together and to make the building strong, and it's called a sway dance. The boys are, they have their staffs, and basically what they're doing is stirring up the ashes from the past of the people before us and people who have passed on, and that after the four posts are marked, it's supposed to lighten your heart so you don't feel the sorrow of the loss of them.
Some people spoke of putting aside past differences among clans. Others extolled the importance of remembering, reclaiming, and revitalizing the culture. The Adzers and others who helped with the rebuilding danced through the house. Finally, everyone was invited to join together in an exit song. The sound of drums reverberated through the walls as dancers' feet pounded the wooden floors. Back outside, Mike DeWitt stands by the house and he's smiling. He says seeing so many young people involved in this event gives him a sense of pride. He says this event is an amazing opportunity for tradition to be passed on from elders to the next generation.
Let's move forward in a happy note, not always a sad note, but a happy note to where youngsters say, yep, that's us, that's me, it's a part of me. And that's where I'm from, and we'll move forward from here. And so living culture, let's live it. Why? Because we're going to practice it.
Linda Churchill said she's seen young people feel disconnected from their culture, but seeing the beauty of the tradition can help rebuild that connection.
It gives you a sense of yourself instead of just, you know, there isn't a whole bunch to do on this little island. And it's like, well, wait a minute, there actually is.
And also just the idea of looking inside a clan house and seeing a real clan house that's spiritually alive, you know, I think it can change people's lives. Give them an example front and center, you know, of just what the Tlingit tradition can do.
Ishmael Hope, whose Tlingit name is Kagwask, was a raven go-between during the ceremony. He says being in the house changes the way he thinks about time and memory.
Suddenly you remember that your life goes back 1,000 years. You're reaching back to that, and it goes directly into the heart.
And this is an event that will be remembered in Wrangell and beyond for generations. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Master of Public Administration at the University of Alaska Southeast is building a network of public administrators across Alaska and the Yukon Territory. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.